Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. The arts in St. Louis help make the community a better place in more ways than one. The new Regional Arts Commission leader in just a couple of moments. But first, beer. It's been something of an art form for a long time here and a big part of life in St. Louis since the city's earliest days. In some ways, it helped put St. Louis on the map because of at least one iconic brand. Ernie Hayes at Busch Stadium, and we all know what beer he's playing about. But there have been dozens of beer brands associated with the city over the past 250 years. Many have disappeared like the foam on a pint, but many more are emerging in an evolving beer environment. The city's beer history is captured in the second edition of St. Louis Brews, The History of Brewing in the Gateway City. Joining me to talk about it in studio are Stephanie Russell and Kevin Caius. They co-authored the book with Don Roussin and the late Hank Herbst. Thank you both so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's a wonderful book. You'll sell a million copies in St. Louis. You know, what I like about it most is how colorful it is. You've got some wonderful signs and menus and everything that just says beer, beer, beer in St. Louis. Nice job.
Yeah, they did a wonderful job of laying it out and all the colorful pictures. That's what we call Brewiana.
Brewiana, okay. Well, I wouldn't want to say that three times fast.
No.
Kevin, let me start with you. What's different about this edition from the first?
Well, the first edition came out in 2009, and so the major difference in this edition is what has happened since then, and it's been kind of amazing what has happened in St. Louis brewing since then because the resurgence of the craft beer industry and the brew pub, St. Louis was a little bit behind the curve in 2009 when it came to establishing craft brewing, but it's really exploded since then.
Yeah, we'll talk in a little more detail about that. Stephanie, you don't look like a beer drinker.
I do. I grew up in Utah, so I didn't drink much of anything. Although, you know, when I turned 21, craft beer was like the thing to drink. So, and that was actually the piece I worked on in the book. The history, the deep history stuff is Kevin and Don and Hank Herbst. And then the piece I worked on for the most part was the microbreweries and the new stuff. But yeah, I drink wine and other things as well. But yeah.
Well, that's a full-time job, keeping track of all the microbreweries and all the craft beers that have emerged.
It is. And unfortunately, I mean, it was sort of a moving target. We were rewriting text before we went to press because things were happening as we were rushing to press. I mean, there are things happening as we speak, which, you know,
it's impossible to keep up with.
Which means there will be a third edition at some point.
No doubt.
Well, before we – let's do this kind of chronologically, sure, if we may. And, Kevin, I'll go back to you for the historical part of it. In terms of beer's history overall worldwide, St. Louis is a relative newcomer.
Well, yeah, if you go back into the 12th century in Europe and that kind of thing. And even around here, there were breweries established in some of the French – colonies in the 1760s, and of course the first evidence of a brewery in St. Louis isn't until 1809.
That surprises me a little bit. I mean, that's what I mean by relatively new.
Sure, yeah, and you know, there could have been breweries in St. Louis before then that nobody wrote down anything about, but yeah, and it was slow to develop in St. Louis. I mean, there were a couple of years in the 18-teens when there supposedly wasn't a brewery, and wasn't until about the 1830s when it started taking off, and you know, the industry was already established in places like Philadelphia and Poughkeepsie, New York, and those kind of places.
Do we have any idea what the beer was like in those days? Is it comparable to anything that we're drinking today?
Well, probably not. I mean, in the early days, they didn't even really understand how yeast worked. It just appeared from the air. And you know, we did not have mechanical refrigeration then, so that made the brewing process much more difficult. But, of course, most of these guys were coming from Germany, and they'd been brewing beer in Germany for centuries. So, you know, they did have some skill and knew what they were doing.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to get to, because that's probably the most important moment in beer history in St. Louis, when the Germans began to emigrate here.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, 95% of the brewers were Germans. There were a few Englishmen and Irish and others. But, yeah, it was a German influx in St. Louis that made the industry.
Stephanie, is there any German influence in the new breweries, the new beers?
Oh, actually, you know, I think definitely, you know, because St. Louis is such a German town. But I think a lot of these breweries have mentioned this book in terms of like drawing on a deep history. Like it's funny because they're very avant-garde in a way, but they also have such a deep respect for the traditions that preceded them. And the other interesting thing I wanted to mention, just in terms of something that we couldn't mention in the book, there's a huge resurgence of women in microbrewing. And actually, brewing was what women did originally. Like, if you go back to ancient Egypt, to really deep beer history, it was the women's job to brew beer. And in medieval times, women brewed the beer. And then it became this kind of macho guy thing. And there's a group called Femme Ferment, which is women microbrewers in St. Louis, which I think is really interesting.
Is this peculiar to St. Louis, or is this happening all over the country in terms of the women involvement?
I think it's happening all over the country, really. I know about Femme Ferment because they're here in St. Louis, but I love that women are getting into what's been a man's game for so long.
There was a resurgence, as we say, with the Germans coming in. How many breweries were there approximately during this middle of the 19th century time?
Probably the most at any one time was in the 1860s. There was probably between 40 and 50. And, you know, St. Louis was a growing town throughout the decades. There was some consolidation in the industry in the late 1800s, early 1900s. But even still then, there were 25 or 30 breweries around. And we're getting close now with the brew pubs, but still not that close.
How many are there, Stephanie? Do you have a number?
Oh, my gosh. Well, it's like a moving target, as we said. Yeah. We included about 25. We mentioned 25, I think, in the book. And but there are more than that. There were some we just had to mention a name, and we couldn't even put a write-up in because we didn't have room, which really makes me sad. I mean, you could do a whole book on microbrewing in St. Louis. It's that deep a culture.
Sure, especially if you counted the surrounding towns. And that's another thing, the resurgence in the last few years, some of the smaller towns in both Illinois and Missouri that hadn't had breweries in 120 years now have breweries.
O'Fallon, yeah, places like that.
Going back, staying with the historical part of it for a moment, my understanding from your book that there were actually neighborhood breweries. They just serviced the neighborhoods.
Oh, yeah, definitely. They only kegged their beer, and they probably went about as far as a horse could go in half a day as far as their distribution area.
What kind of volumes were they brewing in those days, would you guess?
Oh, probably the typical neighborhood brewery might brew 1,000 barrels a year, maybe more, maybe less. That's about what some of the smaller brew pubs brew now. So, yeah, it was indeed a neighborhood history, and neighborhood beer gardens went around along with the brewery and the neighborhood saloons.
Yeah, let's talk about the saloons for a moment, because that's an important part of it. That was very, very important for the brewers to have some place to sell their beer.
It was a huge part of the business, actually. A lot of the saloons were called tied saloons, which meant they only served the beer made by one brewery. Sometimes they were owned by the brewery. Sometimes they were just assisted by the brewery, who provided financing, provided the bar fixtures, provided all the signage.
How long did that last?
It really lasted until Prohibition. And that was part of why the heat was on the brewers prior to Prohibition. Some of the saloons were pretty unsavory places, and that kind of gave the Prohibition movement something to grab onto, the unsavoriness of the saloons. And then it was all ended by Prohibition, pretty much. They went to the three-tiered system where the brewers couldn't distribute their own product. They had to go through a wholesaler. Of course, now it's a little bit different because with the establishment of the brew pubs and the craft beers, they can self-distribute at least to an extent.
Maybe, Stephanie, you can fill us in a little bit on that as to what the restrictions and limitations there are on these new breweries.
On microbreweries?
Yeah.
I don't know the ins and outs of the law part of it. Yeah. I mean, if you talk about it from a cultural point of view, I think a lot of people have connected the microbrewery movement with the local food movement. And so the point is no longer to get as large as possible and sell as many beers as possible. It's more about creating something that has some terroir to it. That's more of a wine term, but it's more about reflecting the place where the beer is from and creating something that's an artistic product, for lack of a better term. You know what I mean? So I think the whole idea is to create something that it's, well, I don't want to say quality versus quantity, because there are a lot of really good sparkly American lagers, but it is just a whole other mindset, I think.
let's again go back, Kevin. We're kind of bouncing back and forth here, but you know, the biggest name in St. Louis obviously is Anheuser-Busch, but there are other big names. Lem comes to mind, Grisetti comes to mind, Falstaff comes to mind. They're all gone now.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, that was part of what made St. Louis such a big brewing town is that places like Lemp, AB, other smaller breweries, Wainwright, Anthony and Kuhn, they were huge exporters of beer. And actually, the term St. Louis lager became more a style of beer. And a lot of brewers out west, when they started opening, they would copy the bottle labels to make it look like St. Louis lager labels.
Did Anheuser-Busch kind of just out-muscle these other folks or competition must have been quite keen.
Competition was fierce, yeah, especially with the shipping breweries. I mean, the eastern breweries became kind of complacent in that they really just wanted to serve more a local market. But St. Louis, being on the western fringe of the brewing industry, wanted to take advantage and ship things west. And boy, did it work out for them. And AB was on top of that. Lemp was larger than Anheuser-Busch for a while in the 1870s, but AB's export market eventually overtook them. And overtook everyone.
Anheuser-Busch, I think, among many of its attributes, marketing, the ability to market and market well, is certainly very close to the top of the list.
Yeah. Outstanding.
Has that always been the case?
I think so, yeah. Going back in the 1860s, I mean, Eberhard Anheuser was in the soap business, and he took what he learned there into the brewing business, and especially once bottled beer became more popular in the export market, and even more so after Prohibition. I mean, absolutely unbelievable how AB dominated the market.
That is quite a jump from soap to beer.
Yes, it is.
I've heard from soup to nuts, but to soap to beer, that doesn't quite make it. We have to take a break. We'll do that now. We are talking about St. Louis's beer history, and with me in studio are co-authors of a book, which is titled St. Louis Brews, The History of Brewing in the Gateway City. With me in studio is Stephanie Russell and Kevin Caius, as I say, co-authors of the book. We'll take some of your calls. I know there are people interested in the subject, and we also already have a couple of people waiting. We'll take their calls when we come back. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Now back to Stephanie Russell and Kevin Pius. Stephanie, let me come to you.
Mm-hmm.
Did I say Pius? Caius. Because it rhymes with Pius. That's the way I have to remember things, folks. I've gotten to that stage. Let me come back to you. As we're talking about Anheuser-Busch, and mm-hmm. your specialty is in the microbreweries and what have you, there was a Busch in that business as well, and that's Billy Busch and Crefty. I guess it's not considered a microbrewery, though. He's trying to compete with the big boys, isn't he?
Yeah, he is. He's kind of a funny hybrid, though, because he nabbed the master brewer from Morgan Street, and their whole thing is the German purity law, you know, brewing.
But Reinheitsgebot.
Yes. My family is French, not German, so uh-huh. I'm like genetically not inclined to be able to pronounce words like that properly. But yeah, I mean, he's interesting because he's definitely unapologetically brewing this sparkling American lager. It's not really a microbrew, but I don't put it exactly in the Coors category either. He's mm-hmm. such a funny hybrid. I find him like one of the more interesting stories in this whole panorama.
You know, the name of his beer is Kräftig, mm-hmm. and I think maybe that was a mistake because it sounds like it's a craft beer. But technically it's not.
Oh, I think he's inherited his forebearer's savvy for marketing. I mean, I think craft beer is the thing right now. And
so
it's sort of a sly, poetic little twist there.
The best of both worlds.
Exactly.
It kind of is.
Yes.
Okay. Back to some of the other history, Kevin, I'll turn to you. You write in the book that the brewing history in this city is really in three phases. What are those phases?
The three phases. Well, the first phase was the establishment of the industry back in the early days, from ground up, how St. Louis became one of the largest brewing centers in the nation. Never number one. I think it was number two for many years. But then, of course, there's the Prohibition era when the whole thing is shut down. And it did really change the industry huge. A lot of the breweries didn't come back. The ones that did you know, they struggled. The 30s and 40s were tough times for the brewing industry. And then, of course, the strong survived and the weak perished. And then, it pretty much stayed the same until the 1980s, and then along came craft brewing on the coasts. And boy, I mean, if you stood around the 1970s and 1980s and tried to make predictions about where the beer industry was going to go, I don't think anybody would have predicted that we'd reach the point that we're at now, and it's a wonderful thing.
Well, I wonder, Stephanie, I wonder the InBev purchase of Anheuser-Busch.
It's key, yeah.
It is key. Maybe we're thinking along the same lines. Key in the sense that it really helped to kind of push along the craft beer microbrewery industry?
Absolutely, yes.
Why?
Well, you know, when I landed in St. Louis in 2001, there was still like very deep loyalty to Anheuser-Busch products. There were people who would drink nothing but, and they had this very robust workforce. And the shift you see after the sale of the company, that loyalty, you know, I think that sale was very traumatic for St. Louis. I remember it being very traumatic. Like, there was this very public mourning of this company being passed, like going from a local company to basically a global conglomerate, you know. And so people who felt like, yeah, AB is my brand, they no longer felt obligated to drink Anheuser-Busch products. And you also had people who worked at AB who had come in from Germany, who were the best of the best at what they did. And they were either laid off or left of their own volition. And,
I think 1,000 yeah. people lost their jobs.
Yes. And they're still, you know, they're still kind of hemorrhaging people trying to get the, you know, company, you know, trying to maximize profits, which is what you do in a large global company. You know, I'm not criticizing them. It's just what you do. But then you get Urban Chestnut, like Florian at Urban Chestnut. I mean, he came from AB. And so you have this pool of talent that's just amazing. And then all of a sudden, they're all brewing craft beer in St. Louis. So it was a win for us, really.
Do you see it the same way, Kevin?
I do, yeah. I mean, part of it, I think, is coincidental. There was probably just a pent-up demand for more craft breweries around here. But, yeah, what Stephanie says is right, and I think people are more apt to try something else. They're not so as loyal to AB, so that, you know, they might try a different beer.
It seems to me that the biggest player right now, Stephanie, mm-hmm. is Tom Schlafly and Schlafly Beer. I mean, that it just, as an observer, it seems to me that they're everywhere.
Well, he was the first person to dip his toe in this hole. And if you read his book, he talks about how controversial it was for a microbrewery to be here in this AB town and how hard it was for him. It was very difficult. And, you know, that's such a huge shift, too, in the story was Schlafly. And I mean, I think they're interesting because – you know, they're not a tiny brewery. They do have aspirations to grow their business, but they're still very much in that craft brew model.
Yeah, they've been happy to grow more slowly.
Yes.
And, of course, now they're trying to expand to Chicago. So
that works. But they've sold. He sold recently. He sold most of his shares, I think.
He did. He's still involved, yeah. But, you know, I think there's sort of an old guard. You know, Morgan Street is selling, and there's an old guard. They were sort of the craft brew pioneers, and they're sort of, you know, retiring. They're getting older. And then you have these younger generations of brewers coming up. It's interesting that we're in the second wave of it now.
Right. So Schlafly is the certainly a force to be reckoned with at this particular juncture.
Absolutely.
Very much so. They're selling a lot of beer.
And their beer is great. So, yeah.
Oh, so you do drink beer. All right.
I do.
I've seen her.
I'd like to get to talk about labor for a moment because labor, it seems to me, the time that I've been in St. Louis, there's always been a kind of a yinging and yanging going on with the people who work for the breweries, if you will, and the breweries themselves.
Oh, sure. Labor versus management. It goes all the way back to the beginning of brewing in St. Louis. Of course, you realize back in those days, most of the workers were living on the grounds of the brewery. They were working 14-hour days, and I don't know, they were probably getting paid 85 cents a day or something. But then the unions became very strong here, and you know, they did a fantastic job of making the lot of the brewery worker a lot better. They were fighting for 10-hour days and half days off on Sundays and that kind of thing. And, of course, then AB and Falstaff and the big brewers that were still around in the 50s, the unions were powerful, and what a great job they had.
What happened to them, Falstaff, for instance, in the 50s and others that went away?
Yeah, it's an interesting story with Falstaff, a kind of a meteoric plunge. They their business was going downhill. They couldn't keep up. Part of the problem, I think, was that they tended to buy old breweries that weren't in as good a shape rather than buying new breweries. And then they were bought by a guy named Cal Manovitz, who was kind of an evil person in the brewing industry, if you have to say. And, you know, once he was purchased by them, they could see the writing on the wall. And, you know, the people that worked there knew their jobs weren't going to be around much longer. And so they cheapened the formula. They started selling everything off and, you know, just doing everything they could to milk what was left of the corporation and eventually leaving St. Louis in 77 and eventually closing all their breweries throughout the country by the early 90s.
Stephanie, is in the current landscape, is labor relations an issue?
You know, I don't know the answer to that so much. I mean, I remember it being a huge deal. Like, for instance, with Lure Distributing, there was a lot of taverns that would not stock AB because of the labor issue, and I haven't heard noises around that for a while. I mean, the microbrew thing, it's like the startup thing.
They're small.
You know, it's a different model.
Yeah, small, yeah. And they wouldn't be subject to unionization as
not
readily.
Yet.
Not yet.
Yeah. Actually, a very interesting question you pose there, Don.
Right.
You know, I think part of it, you know, that it's kind of a hobby for some of them.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, Alpha Brewing, for instance, like a lot of the people who have come up through like Alpha Brewing, they were home brewers. And a lot of the people who are brewing professionally now started in their garage or their basement. So, yeah, it really is like a startup.
Yeah. Let's take a couple of calls. 382-8255 is our number. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email to talk@stlpublicradio.org, or if you prefer to send us a tweet, do so at STL on air. We'll start with Ken calling from St. Louis. Ken, thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
How you doing? Don't watch. Great show.
Great. Go ahead.
I've been listening all the way. I didn't know how to get in the air, but I was just like asking, like, what role – like the German, like brewers, like played during the Prohibition, like where they link up with the mob. I'm like, I know you're talking about Michael Brewer, but I'm just like asking what role the German played, like during Prohibition, since they imported the science of brewery, like, you know, when you know about Lohenbrau, Cronenberg, and everything. So Ken, I just wanted to know if they had link with the mob, Ken, or like they were targeted by Elliot Ness.
We've got it, Ken. Thanks very much. Well, you address this in the book.
Well, yeah, we do to an extent. I mean, there was all kinds of, I guess it's more in other books than ours, some of the AB stuff and what they were up to during Prohibition. Mostly what they were up to in St. Louis was trying to save their employees' jobs by diversifying and doing anything they possibly could to keep the plant open. And, yeah, I mean, some of the breweries here tried to bootleg beer in the early 20s. I think they all got caught. And
you mentioned that they had to do other things to survive during Prohibition. What are some of the things that they did in order to do that?
Well, a lot of them tried near beer, and that didn't work very well. As they say, whoever called it near beer was a poor judge of distance. But they tried soda. I mean, Anheuser-Busch did crazy things like building refrigerators and, you know, all kinds of non-beverage-related things.
Produced yeast and things like that.
Yeast really helped keep AB alive during the 20s and early 30s, no doubt about that.
Let's take another call. David joins us from the Tower Grove neighborhood. Go ahead, David.
First of all, thank you to the office for this book. The first edition was beautiful, and I've actually been hunting for it on the used market, and it's such an amazing book. I'm so glad that there's a second edition. My question is about the beautiful Limp Brewery, the Western Brewery down at Limp and Cherokee. I've seen a promotional photo from, I think, pre-Prohibition that shows these massive wooden vats that they used to brew in. A lot of the German brewers, of course, came to St. Louis because of the natural underground caves that were ideal before the days of refrigeration. So my question has to do with those large vats. I'm wondering, I've always been curious, it seems like they were so massive, these wooden vats, that they would be really difficult to disassemble. And my question is if through the course of your research, if you know if those vats were disassembled or if they're still actually in those lagering vaults underneath the Limp Brewery.
Yeah, there's nothing left down there as far as the lagering vats go. I don't know if they eventually deteriorated or what happened to them. Brown Shoe, of course, took over the Limp complex in the 20s, and I'm sure they hastily removed all the parts of the, from the portions that they were going to use. And they definitely threw out all the old Lemp records. So, you know, most of the old Lemp history went in the trash with Brown Shoe.
Well, you point out that in the early days, the beer was cooled in canoes.
Yeah, that's I don't know if that's an urban legend or not, but a lot of times that's what they say. The first brewers, they were so desperate they didn't have the proper cooperage, so they used a canoe or a pierogi or something like that.
The times have changed. Let's take another call. Jerry joins us from O'Fallon. Jerry, good to hear from you again.
Yes, good afternoon. I just want to say that I've been at the tail end of a lot of different eras, but I'm glad to say that I've been witness to, I think, a booming the brewing era in the United States. I remember the first time I visited Europe over 30 years ago and sampled the different varieties of beers, and then you'd come back here and there was like, you know, the handful of large factory beers and their light counterparts, and if you wanted something really fancy, you might be able to get a six-pack of Heineken or something. And from that point to where we are now, where there's regional beers and beers in almost any city I go to has several varieties, microbrews, pubs, etc. I think it's a great thing. It's great to see that variety come back.
Jerry, thanks for the call. Stephanie?
I just wanted to mention, actually, Side Project Brewery in Maplewood has just been named as like one of the top breweries, or top 100 breweries in the world. So we really are on the map.
By whom?
Beer Advocate, I believe. It was definitely somebody who was, it wasn't some website. It was definitely a legitimate source.
This may sound a little off the wall, but St. Louis City certainly is very proud of its water. And I think it's supposed to have some of the best water in the country. Does water make a difference? Our water here make a difference in our beers?
Well, water is probably the most important ingredient in beer. But I think we've reached a point now where the brewing chemists can do just about anything possible with water. I mean, a place like Burton on Trent, England, became famous because the water was good for brewing. It was a hard water, which is the best for brewing. I know a place like AB prides themselves on they brew with the same water at every brewery they got. Now, so far as some of the smaller breweries, I don't know. I think St. Louis water is still good for brewing beer.
Also with AB, they use rice as part of their formula as opposed to barley. Is that correct?
Correct, yeah. Rice and corn are common adjuncts used in brewing.
Does anybody else do that? I mean, I think that's quite different, I believe.
Well, most of the mega brewers, your Coors, your Millers, all the mega beers are brewed with rice or corn as an adjunct, definitely.
Stephanie, any of that going on that you're aware of in the microbreweries?
In terms of ingredients?
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
Rice and water. Well,
it
water,
goes way beyond that. I mean, if you get into the microbreweries, they're flavored with all kinds of crazy things, like chocolate nibs and, you know what I mean? It really comes down to finishing it with really exotic ingredients sometimes. So, and I think the rice and the corn, it just sort of gives it a smoother taste, right, Kevin?
Yeah, it makes it easier to filter and, not as strong as taste as the barley. I mean, they started brewing beer with rice and corn in the 1870s, 1880s. But, you know, it's considered an adjunct because it doesn't add to the flavor. Whereas when the microbrewers are using some of the more exotic ingredients, it's not considered an adjunct because it does add to the flavor.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe it's nitpicking.
Yeah. Stephanie, is there a sense of competition amongst the microbrewers?
I think I've been really impressed with how they cooperate. I think it's a very, cooperative, supportive environment from what I've seen. Of course, I'm not behind the scenes, but that's just the sense I get. There's a Brewers Guild, which I believe AB is a part of. People play nice in St. Louis. It's just who we are.
Are they still fighting regulations? I mean, we know that Tom Schlafly was very, very involved in getting certain laws changed so that they could produce more beer. Is there still a regulatory inhibition, if you will?
I mean, I don't get the sense of that so much. I don't know the minutiae with the law, but I mean, they seem pretty free to be able to do what they set out to do. Maybe Kevin could jump in on this one if he...
Yeah, the laws have been modernized. I mean, as the industry grows, there may be some laws concerning barrelage and that kind of thing that would need to be looked at. But no, it's a nice cooperative environment. And
We only have 1 minute left, and I've got to have you, Kevin, tell the story about the Clydesdales and the White House at the end of Prohibition very quickly.
Oh, boy. Let's see. Do I remember that one? That was how the Clydesdales actually began. I don't know if they had – I don't even know if AB used Clydesdales to transport their beer, but it was a present from August Bush to his father that he brought out the team of Clydesdales here at the brewery to deliver the beer to
– actually brought them to Washington, if I recall.
They ended up in,
they delivered a sizable amount of beer to Franklin Roosevelt.
To Franklin Roosevelt. He was a hero to the brewing industry.
Well, and to a lot of his citizens as well, no question about that. Anything you want to add before we say goodbye?
No, I'd just like to echo that one caller that we are indeed lucky to be living in this craft brewing period here and get to sit down at all these different places here in St. Louis and have a fresh beer.
And you get a chance to work with Stephanie and putting all of this together.
That was very nice, too.
I want to thank you both so much for being with us. Congratulations on the book. It's a wonderful book, and I'm sure you'll get a lot of readers. Thank you very much, Kevin Caius and Stephanie Russell. Best of luck to you. We'll be back in just a moment with the new head of the Regional Arts Commission. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.